Gritty, The Grey Zone and The Child Witness in Catastrophe Literature. Thanks, Jack.
Okay, and although there's not that many of you, at least one or two of you may already have seen a version of this paper at the ASCP, but it's got longer. Okay. The 1995 publication of Binyamin Vukmirsky's memoir, Fragments, Memories of a Wartime Childhood, represented an innovation in Holocaust literature. An autobiographical account of a very young child's internment and torture in concentration camps. The author's survival was thought to be incredible, and the clarity of his depictions of extreme violence recuperated from fragments of childhood memory, impressive. The book's success became a source of embarrassment for the literary community when 3 years later it was declared to be the confabulation of deluded Gentile Bruno Dersica, rather than the memoir of Holocaust survivor Binyamin Vukmirsky. Even before its publication, doubts had been raised about the memoir's authenticity, inconsistencies between the author's documentation and his story, and between his account of Maidenik and those of other survivors made early readers wary. Yet the book was rewarded with superlative reviews, became a bestseller, and attracted prizes and accolades from Jewish peak bodies before it was exposed as fraudulent, and its author as the survivor of the Swiss foster care system rather than of Auschwitz. Much of the book's appeal was its attempt to reconstruct a narrative of improbable survival from the fragments of a child's disjointed experience and incomplete perspective. As one reviewer of Fragments wrote, "It is the view from far below, from very early on, that is, the child's perspective, that upsets, outrages, shames us." I would suggest this upset, outrage and shame produced by the child's perspective had also drawn the reader into an uneasy identification with the child narrator. Little Binyamin presented an ideal of innocence and vulnerability, and the reader identified as much with this vulnerability as with one who might protect it, and more obscurely, with the perpetrators of violence against him. Ultimately, the child's fragmentary view from below provides a scene into which the reader may invest and manage feelings of shame, complicity and responsibility for the plight of those like him. Readers were motivated to believe in Binyamin Vukmirsky because their intimate engagement with him helped to mediate their complicated investments in the Holocaust and had even promised to absolve them of their guilt. Once Fragments was revealed as a fake, the intensity of public investment in the truth of Vukmirsky became palpable. This disclosure added humiliation to existing feelings of shame in his readership, who had made of Vukmirsky a symbol for all suffering and outrage belonging to the persecuted. It also starkly revealed the dialectical structures that confer authority in testimonial discourse as such, and brought to light the allure of the figure of wounded childhood as a focus of identification. This paper will read Fragments alongside Anne Frank's diary and Imre Kertész's Fateless to explore the seductiveness of representations of childhood in testimonial literature and the work they perform in managing ambivalence regarding responsibility for injustice or atrocity. The child offers an apparently uncomplicated way into the subjective experience of victimhood through personal identification with the part of the innocent, the one who can do no harm and so is most blameless. This investment reveals a desire for a Manichaean simplicity that, as Primo Levi teaches, grey zones such as Auschwitz do not allow. Contemplation of the child as a site of suffering and vulnerability allows readers to negotiate for themselves a limited security against moral ambiguity and the felt threat of complicity such ambiguity elicits. Yet while the child figure represents innocence and subjective simplicity, it may equally represent volatility, social breakdown, or moral insecurity. Childhood uncannily reveals the community's moral vulnerabilities by alternately encapsulating and resisting social expectations. the ethical insights availed by the child as witness to human catastrophe thereby depend on the extent to which expectations of childhood can be unsettled or open to revision. The child became especially sensible as a site of identification, I contend, after the influence of trauma theory, with its emphasis on ineffability, or what is taken to be a constitutive gap between experience and the witness's ability to testify to it. Undoubtedly, Freud's account of trauma possesses a certain explanatory power regarding the experiences of survivors, yet trauma theory's appeal to the impossibility of comprehending the Holocaust is ethically paralysing and aversive of both moral ambiguity and responsibility. Such theoretical developments, I contend, open the way to the kind of impasse of authenticity, guilt and identity that Wilkomirski represents. Indeed, this impasse may be trauma theory's most interesting and productive moment. In what follows, I will consider Wilkomirski's apparent success in embodying the survivor's subjective experience before exploring the more complicated ethical terrain designated by Levy's grey zone, through which the reader's complicity with the catastrophic situation may be better understood. I will address these insights to trauma theory before reinterpreting the innocent child in accounts of catastrophe, drawing on Agamben's account of infancy as a social responsibility grounded in mutual uncertainty and openness. I will show how the child witness, if read against the grain of conventional accounts of childhood, returns us to our own infancy, helping us to comprehend the grey zone. So the success of Fragments and its reader's sense of betrayal were both in large part due to its frame. The child narrator disarmed readers of any scepticism or critical distance they might otherwise have brought to a purported Holocaust memoir. Wilkomirski draws sharp boundaries between goodies and baddies that also align to the opposition's child-adult and Jew-Nazi. These binaries are delineated at the outset, where the author establishes his authority as orphan child, whose perspective gives rise to a more authentic phenomenology than adulthood. So it's a long quote. "I have no mother tongue nor a father tongue either. My language has its roots in the Yiddish of my eldest brother Mordecai, overlaid with the Babel babble of an assortment of children's barracks in the Nazis' death camps in Poland. My earliest memories are a rubble field of isolated images and events, shards of memory with hard knife-sharp edges which still cut flesh if touched today. Mostly a chaotic jumble with very little chronological fit, shards that keep surfacing against the orderly grain of grown-up life and escaping the laws of logic." He then makes a pact with his readers. "If I'm going to write about it, I have to give up the ordering logic of grown-ups. It would only distort what happened. I survived. Quite a lot of other children did too. The plan was for us to die, not survive. According to the logic of the plan and the orderly rules they devised to carry it out, we should have been dead." Notably, Nazis here become grown-ups with their ordering logic, and the child's fragmented perspective is conflated with Wilkomirski's disjointed recollections. The reader's demand for clarity or accuracy in this context allies them to the Nazis, who operate according to a grown-up logic. Likewise, doubt becomes tantamount to Holocaust denial. Readers are thus corralled into an uncritical identification with the child Wilkomirski. Yet such identification has its own dividends and is not merely coercive. The simplistic moral landscape of Wilkomirski's world is attractive and yields exceptionally excessive moral figures through which readers may divest themselves of uncertainty regarding their own stake in the Nazi war crimes. The guileless child protagonist is pitted against all manner of callous adult, from brutal SS officer to strict orphanage warden. At surface, then, the choice is easy, which figure offers itself as an attractive locus of identification, and which are evil, even repulsive. Yet, as psychoanalysis teaches, identification is never so simple. Even where there is no conscious identification, and especially where there is repulsion, this strongly indicates that unconscious identification has taken place. The process of abjection or projective identification signals a deeper and more complex investment in the other, powerfully motivated by feelings of guilt, shame, ambivalence, and uncertainty. The figures of moral excess in fragments, then, give rise to multiple identifications in the reader. The child elicits feelings of parental protectiveness, but also beckons to a sense of the reader's own innocence, vulnerability, and loss. More intriguingly, however, are feelings of shame in the face of the child's perspective suggested earlier by the reviewer Earls Rookstuhl, a shame that reveals one's adult position of privilege and which is motivated, perhaps, by an unacknowledged identification with the adult agents of Binyamin's suffering. This darker identification also indicates the more complex ethical implications of events such as Auschwitz, as addressed by Levy in The Drowned and the Saved. Written more than 40 years after liberation from Auschwitz, this book speaks to the vagaries of memory and feelings of shame and guilt that characterise survival, and what Levy calls the grey zone, that is, the complicated social landscape the National Socialists invented in the camp. It is, he writes, that zone of ambiguity which radiates out from regimes based on terror and obsequiousness. Levy criticises the Manichaean structure of Holocaust Memorial, exposing instead the Germans' implication of Jews in their own extermination through the allocation of minimal privileges and functions that prolonged individual survival. The capos, prisoner thugs allowed to beat other prisoners, Sonderkommandos, or special squad who administered the gas chambers, and even Levy's own position as chemist, manufacture a humiliating complicity in victims that, for Levy, robs them even of the consolation of innocence. The corrupting factor in this scene is privilege and the security it offers in setting some even minimally apart from the rest. Levy laments that those internees who were able to fulfil a purpose for the Germans and so afforded some privilege disproportionately represent survivors. Survival is contaminated by this privilege for Levy and the shame of having had an advantage over others. On the face of it, Binyamin Wilkomirski suppresses this difficult inference and so would seem to relieve his readers of their implication in others' disadvantage by offering them figures of purity and abjection, but no complicated grey zone. An ultimate victim with no power or privilege, Binyamin was able to survive despite his innocence, and so offers a site of identification that does not trouble readers in their subjectivity. And yet we can make sense of readers' shame in this instance, in the first instance, as a result of a repressed identification with his abusers. In the second, the exposure of the lie and their desire for it shames, because this desire demonstrates a defensive investment in sharp moral boundaries, in the idea that evil is perpetrated only by monsters, as if all others were innocent as children. Okay. So taking a step back and withholding for the moment judgment of Wilkomirski's fraudulence and his reader's credulity, let's consider the particular qualities of testimonial discourse and its peculiar relation to truth. Testimony about Nazi crimes against the Jewish people has always been both driven and vexed by the question of memory. Understood as a movement of resistance against Europe's active forgetfulness of the programs and failures to intervene that culminated in the near annihilation of a people, testimony is undoubtedly political, demonstrating as it does the existence of survivors who have made it their duty to remember for others what was supposed to pass unnoticed and unrepresented. Memory of the precise facticity of those events, however, sometimes falls short of the desired evidentiary threshold, establishing an affective and existential rather than purely historical context to events, a structure of experience rather than a register of objective data. Especially once it is complicated by considerations of trauma, what testimony reveals is rendered ambiguous and potentially sacred. Theorists and philosophers, such as Shoshana Feldman, Dori Laub, and Jean-François Lyotard, have made a virtue of memory's uncertain status in Holocaust testimony, precisely by identifying in the traumatised, damaged, and partial recall of the survivor an unknowability fundamental to subjectivity. Survivors' inability to represent their own truth renders them dependent on a witness whose task is to divine what the silences, gaps, and inconsistencies within their accounts portend. To be sure, witness testimony of Nazi genocide from liberation onward has met with various forms of silencing. After 1945, survivors quickly learned that no one was interested in hearing their war stories. It wasn't until the 1960s that conventional publishers began to commission accounts of the Jewish experience, but by the 80s there was an explosion of testimonial literature available to a non-Jewish public. The form this material took was the result of silencing of a different kind, as there was strong internal pressure to universalise the message in order to promote identification of Gentile readers with the experiences of camp internees. Personal stories of persecution that had taken place for the least personal of reasons had to be related so as not to alienate a non-Jewish, residually anti-Semitic public. There was a felt imperative that narrative would need to suppress pangs of guilt or acknowledgement of complicity in its readers. The brutal persecution of the Jews became an archetypal instance of man's inhumanity to man, rather than a very specific political and historical situation, which allowed to protract into catastrophe had prompted neither intervention nor comment from the global community. The perceived benefit of playing down the specificity of those crimes would be an expansion of the field of those who might identify themselves as potential victims, and thereby more easily sympathise with the suffering of those who had been subjected to those crimes. Invested with the purpose of convincing potential sceptics of the scale and manner of Nazi crimes, witnessing came to be shaped by the implicit possibility of fraud and deception. According to Shoshana Feldman and Dori Laub, chief exponents of trauma theory, this context of reception prolongs trauma in the survivors, who begin even to doubt themselves. This is because the structure of subjectivity is dialogical. It is founded in relation to the other, the form of which is installed within the self as judgment. As Kelly Oliver puts this, having a sense of oneself as a subject and an agent requires that the structure of witnessing as the possibility of address and response has been set up in dialogic relations with others. The inner witness, then, is the structure of subjectivity as addressability itself, the structure of witnessing. Due to the existence of pes lyotard, a differon, or fundamental condition of misrecognition, there is a breakdown in this dialogical structure of subjectivity, and ultimately the survivor misrecognises herself. Without an interlocutor to receive and support their memory through dialogue, the survivor ceases to remember. There is no thou, not even within the self, to whom one remembers. And finally, according to Laub, the survivor deceives herself, is separated from her memory. That the events in question are so incredible has led some theorists to ascribe to testimony itself, and not only those who testify, the quality of trauma. Accordingly, on one hand, survivors exclude shocking experiences from accessible memory in order to preserve a coherent sense of self, secure the ego from damage. On the other hand, this process is generalised in trauma theory because the events survivors describe sit so incongruously within the fabric of history, it's held. Cultural resources to help comprehend the meaning of the Holocaust are unavailable. It thus becomes impossible to understand the Jewish catastrophe in principle rather than only de facto. Laub and Fellman argue this most forcefully, characterising Nazi murder of Jews as an event without witness, because the inherently incomprehensible and deceptive psychological structure of the event precluded its own witnessing, even by its victims. For these commentators, the catastrophe remains such an outlier in the field of human experience that witnesses do not have a language to describe it. And moreover, this failure to comprehend that comprises trauma affects all who attempt to gain knowledge of the genocide of European Jews by means of what's called vicarious trauma. Trauma theory itself is concerned with how witnessing embodies trauma, which in turn establishes an ethical relation. This ethical relation is situated in the structure of subjectivity given by trauma, that the subject's defining moment is also a missed encounter, which is inexpressible and is only brought out of its latency by another. The other stands security for the survivor's truth by watching over his or her silences and recuperating them to an overarching narrative. Trauma theory's poignancy, what Karen Ball calls its poignancy capital, emerges then from an effort to recruit testimony's apparent ineffability as its hidden power. The theorist speaks the unspeakable, comprehends the unknowable. The effect is a kind of mysticism that not only produces an epistemological hierarchy, but also engenders credulity and suspends critical engagement. A precondition of trauma theory commonly found in survivor narratives is survivor's guilt, which is well exemplified by Primo Levi. Levi draws a moral distinction between his own condition and that of those who touched bottom and did not survive, taking on responsibility to witness for them. Agamben reinterprets Levi's paradox as the lacuna that structures testimony, that the ones left to tell did not touch bottom and so did not experience that ultimate crime that demands witnessing. And this is just a little quote from Agamben. How can the true witness be the one who by definition cannot bear witness? This is akin to Henry Vermouth's statement that the closest witnesses to violent and forcible death are the dead. Yet Levi's paradox is profounder than this, forming the very identity of the survivor who testifies in the place of the true witness. Both identification and repudiation are at work here, as the survivor both speaks for the Musulman and bears the guilt of his fate. Both sympathises with the Musulman's existential condition of no longer feeling or judging, of having been virtually stripped of one's humanity, and places a distance between them, as between the subject and the abject. Jean Amery demonstrates this well, and this is also quoted by Agamben. The so-called Musulman, as camp language termed the prisoner who was giving up and was given up by his comrades, no longer had room in his consciousness for the contrast, good or bad, noble or base, intellectual or unintellectual. He was a staggering corpse, a bundle of physical functions in its last convulsions. As hard as it may be for us to do so, we must exclude him from our considerations. Survivor's guilt, thus compounded by such repudiation of the one who could not survive, forming a dense identificatory knot that renders the survivor responsible both for the memory of the departed and unconsciously for their demise. This guilt is observed by survivors, and particularly Levi, in the necessary gap that characterises their construal of witnessing. Witnessing thus understood is always mediated and so stands in the place of a trauma that, by definition, is out of reach of consciousness. The truth of testimony comes to be always at one remove from what is actually said, suppressed in the interstices of language and indeed is best represented by a muteness or infancy so profound that it admits of no adequate expression. Okay. So I'm going to turn to infancy now. And in the original paper, there's a lot more on Lacan, so you'll have to forgive this cursory treatment of Lacan. So Jacques Lacan famously made sense of the meaning of the term infancy by drawing it back to its Latin derivation, infans, one who does not speak. Infancy, for Lacan, precedes the subject, which is constituted through a split between the symbolic self, elaborated as the I in language, and the unconscious that evades capture by language. In trauma theory, then, silence or ineffability is associated with the unconscious and with a truth that escapes one's own knowledge. As Fellman and Laub argue with respect to witnessing, the value of testimony is not simply in the words that constitute it, but rather in its performance, through which gaps in the narrative and knowledge are demonstrated. Witnesses struggle with what they cannot formulate is then epistemologically significant, and moreover, it's ethically significant, as the receiver's engagement with silences in survivor testimony produces a further vicarious trauma akin to the phenomenon of secondary trauma in the children of survivors who bear the burden of what their parents cannot speak. This imperative to listen to the silences in oral testimony has also seen a shift in attention from adult survivors to child witnesses, previously considered too young to have fully experienced or be able to remember those events. In the new discursive context furnished by trauma theory, this feature of the child survivor makes them excellent exemplars of the problematic of witnessing more generally. As unconscious of the greater part of their experience, they are seen to act out this experience rather than speak it. As infans, one without speech, child survivors are even more reliant on the dialectical structure of subjectivity, whereby the other gives them back their truth by witnessing it for them. This can be seen in the rise of therapy that aimed to recover memory in the 1980s. Child survivors' testimonies were extracted in adulthood by a brutal and somewhat unreliable hermeneutic that placed the therapist in the role of midwife to their past. But also in literature and philosophy, the child has come to represent an archetype of the true witness, the one who cannot speak their own truth, relying on a therapist or reader to do so in their stead. Agamben exploits this significance of childhood, although we will see that he takes it in quite a different ethical direction. In Remnants of Auschwitz, he retells Primo Levi's account of a child he encountered in Auschwitz, an enfant sauvage of the concentration camp, who might be read as Wilko Mirsky's uncanny double. In order to make a larger point about the unspoken and its integral connection to subjectivity and ethics, this child, whom the camp calls Herbenek, was an object of fascination for adults because he spoke only meaningless syllables, and internees who knew all the languages of Europe could only guess at what this babble might signify. Levy writes of the child who died days after liberation, "Nothing remains of him. He bears witness through these words of mine." The child here can be seen as a figure for the silence that inheres in testimony and which requires an interpreter to endow it with meaning. As in fans, the complete witness, he who by definition cannot bear witness, the child comes to embody the lacuna that gives the structure of witnessing. Yet importantly for Agamben, this incapacity of speech that Herbenek represents also gives the possibility of language. The camp internees are fascinated with Herbenek not only because he is a curiosity, he also crystallises for them the meaning and possibility of communication, of witnessing, and of ethical community. Infancy in Agamben's sense of the word is not the silent other, but rather whose truth we recuperate, but rather an uncanny element of the self. Infancy then cannot be reduced to the figures of Herbeneck or Binyamin and is not confined to the unknowing child witness or survivor. Instead, infancy represents the uncertainty in each of us that gives the possibility of ethics. Infancy in this sense does not then designate a purity, and nor should it engender mysticism. Infancy is understood rather as a moment of uncertainty that reprises the grey zone and through which all negotiate their own potentiality to be perpetrator, protector, or victim. It gives the possibility of ethical knowledge as an apprehension of this indeterminate possibility, that action is forged in indeterminacy, and that once one acts and so negates or sets aside one's indeterminacy, one becomes complicit in history's outcomes. Paraphrasing Levy, it is this complicity that underwrites survival. This is starkly illustrated by Levy with the exemplar of Rumkowski, the emperor of the Lodz ghetto. Like Rumkowski, we too are so dazzled by power and prestige as to forget our essential fragility. Willingly or not, we come to terms with power, forgetting that we are all in the ghetto, and the ghetto is walled in, that outside the ghetto reigns the lords of death, and that close by the train is waiting. The privilege that separates one from the other and repudiates the other's fate also demonstrates the closeness in identity between the one and the other. At a fundamental level, Rumkowski was the same as his Jews and could not shelter himself from exposure to the Nazi death machine. The train came for him just as it came for those whom he had managed for the Germans. He was also undoubtedly complicit in this outcome, however, an actor in the chain of events that precipitated his people into the gas chambers. Rumkowski became a player by negating his infancy or giving expression to a particular stake in the situation. What he neglected was his own vulnerability, the nascent and unforeseen potentialities that annihilated his security, leading him also to be murdered at Auschwitz. Levy's own ambivalent identification with Rumkowski is perceptible in this passage, as he bids us not to take for granted our security, not to be duped by the fantasy that evil is always elsewhere, or that we, by virtue of our humanity and belonging to a community, are indemnified against complicity with evil. Okay, I'm now going to move on, I think, to the readings of child witnesses in literature. Herbeneck, the mute enfant sauvage of Levy's Auschwitz, embodied for his fellows an inarticulate truth of community, humanity, and their particular situation. Just what truth the child witness can deliver, however, is subject to various struggles and attentions. For childhood can be viewed as familiar and domesticated, sentimentally confirming community values. And conversely, the child can appear as radically other, thereby confounding those same values and even demonstrating the part of the perpetrator that resides within the community and against which the community fails to secure itself. This latter uncanny child of Holocaust literature demonstrates a truth of the community that it would rather not own, truths that resist assimilation to group identity narratives, and so are more genuinely traumatic. Insofar as the child figure complicates attempts to secure good from evil, it also confronts readers with their own infancy, or the uncertain potentiality for evil that brings us into ethical relation to others. Okay. So Anne Frank is now the best known child witness of Nazi persecution of Jews, even though her diaries don't involve the Nazis particularly. She's in an attic. Through the publication of her edited diaries and the Broadway play and Hollywood films based on it, her story provided an accessible introduction to contemplating the Holocaust for many non-Jews, especially Americans, and was arguably also a catalyst for Germans to begin to process the meaning of their part in genocide. Frank was a highly sympathetic face of wartime Jewishness. Interestingly, however, her Jewishness was not a feature of her reception, as curious elisions presented a different and for each cultural context. In Germany, the fact that the Franks were from Germany, so their fellow countrymen, was omitted from the translation, as were passages where Anne calls Germans enemies of the Jews and their language barbaric. The nationality of her persecutors is also obscured, so that a psychological distancing was able to take place. Germans could identify with Anne without having to realise their own collective culpability in her plight. Meantime, in America, largely at the behest of her father Otto, Anne was presented as an all-American girl next door, and her diaries as a coming-of-age story documenting the universal struggle of adolescence. Otto Frank was concerned to downplay the cultural and political background of their persecution, so that sections of the diary in which Anne had thoughtfully contemplated this context were omitted from its dramatic adaptations. The price of this intensification of Anne Frank as a figure of identification for the reader is that she also becomes a figure of redemption. Rather than show scenes of her arrest by the SS or her untimely death from typhoid at Bergen-Belsen, which, of course, her words do not disclose in the diary, the play ends with a line from her diary now routinely mistaken to be its last. Okay, so in spite of everything, I still believe people are really good at heart. And Otto's retort by voiceover, "She puts me to shame," which is apparently the appropriate response to children's witnessing. This act of absolution given by Anne Frank, or the fictitious Anne Frank, allowed the audience to leave the theatre in good spirits, despite the events of recent history that had been represented to them. Yet the diary itself presents a very different interiority, wherein Anne struggles with the gendered expectations imposed by those with whom she was sharing the annex, that she should be quieter, more deferential, less opinionated, less greedy. Together with her reflections on the persecution of the Jews and sometimes very dark assessments of humankind, Anne's complaints about her neighbours and their dissatisfaction with her comprise a wholly more complex picture of girlhood, one that resists accession to the demands of her community. Ironically, the last diary entry, far from extolling the goodness of humanity, reflects precisely on the insurmountable interval between the socialised Anne, who presents herself to others as light-hearted, flirtatious and pleasingly feminine, and her hidden seriousness, uncertainty and pessimism. The diary ends with the words, "If only there were no other people in the world," a condition that she feels would allow her to become who she could be and would like to be. Imre Kertész's autobiographical or semi-autobiographical Fateless presents a more complex, inassimilable narrative of survival in which the child's unusual performance of responsibility to community brings forth less palatable truths about the possibility of community. Kertész's novel challenges a number of orthodoxies regarding Holocaust testimony. He does not affirm a meaningfully Jewish life. He does not affirm a meaningfully Jewish life before his removal to the camps, which is a convention of Holocaust literature. He does not particularly identify with Jewishness, and unlike Anne Frank, refuses to read into the events that arbitrarily befall him a deeper significance of being one of the chosen people. He does not try especially hard to comprehend what's happening around him, but nor does he take an anti-intellectual, action-oriented stance, as many other male child witness accounts do. Yuri, Kertész's protagonist and alter ego, puzzles over what the appropriate response to the seriousness of his adults might be, but seems indifferent to whether he actually gets it right. And here's from the film representation, Yuri. Yuri is relatively attached to his childhood status, at the periphery of adults' attention. He gets by unnoticed, observing their worldly engagement with anthropological solicitude. Again, unlike Frank, he is not eager to join the world of adults and is comfortably passive. This renders Yuri an apt witness as he coolly reflects on the strangeness of the attempt to preserve a degree of control and optimism that possesses those around him. Many depictions of the child witness trade on the incompleteness of the child's perspective, their misunderstanding of context and failure to realise their own vulnerability. In order to recruit the reader's sense of capacity as protector and knower, Kitesh, by contrast, affords his reader no comfortable epistemological advantage. They are subjected to Yuri's partial perspective and thereby brought uneasily to appreciate its peculiar insight. If the reader is to identify with Yuri, then, it must be with his infancy, his pregnant incapacity, rather than with a figure of innocence to appropriate and enjoy and through which the dehiscence of subjectivity is repudiated. Yuri's insight, along with Agamben and Lacan, is that all are always yet to be completed, and it is this apprehension of such an integral insufficiency that allows there to be ethics and agency at all. This insight is brought to bear in the final chapter of Fateless, where Yuri returns home from Auschwitz to Budapest. And you can see he's quite an uncanny figure in this scene. Like he's a piece of the camp in the streets of Budapest. Yuri, who had been a silent witness until this point, now finds himself compelled to speak. First to a young journalist and then to two uncles who had somehow managed to evade deportation. First, the journalist encourages Yuri to speak of the horrors of the camps and the hell that they represent, to help reveal to Hungarians the excesses of the Nazis' crimes. Yuri frustrates the journalist's expectations by undercutting the rhetoric of horror, stating instead that the deprivations he had undergone were quite natural, that in a concentration camp they were natural. The effect of Yuri's response, besides undermining the reporter's dramatic narrative, is to bring Auschwitz back with him into the life that he must continue in Budapest. He thereby resists the separation that is at this point already forming between everyday Budapest and what had taken place in the camps. Later in the same chapter, Yuri's uncles describe life in Budapest over the past year in curiously passive terms. The Yellow Star houses came about. October the 15th came about. The Arrow Cross regime came about. The ghetto came about. The Danube Bank shootings came about. Liberation came about. The uncles then encourage Yuri to put the horrors behind him and make plans for the future, but are frustrated when he replies that he cannot give orders to his memory. Yuri then likens his uncle's passivity with regard to those events, their resignation to a discreet life under Nazism, to life in the camps, and particularly the selection queue, where one simply took one step at a time. Yuri addresses here the very limited agency of those in the camps and those remaining at home, within the finite horizon of taking the next step or refusing to take the next step, in which case one would not be allowed to survive. This is another extended quote. There are only given situations and new givens inherent in them. I too had lived through a given fate. It had not been my own fate, but I had lived through it, and I simply couldn't understand why they couldn't get it into their heads that I now needed to start doing something with that fate, needed to connect it to somewhere or something. After all, I could no longer be satisfied with the notion that it had all been a mistake, blind fortune, some kind of blunder, let alone that it had not even happened. I took the steps, no one else, and I declared that I had been true to my given fate throughout. Did they want this whole honesty and all these previous steps I had taken to lose all meaning? Yuri introduces here an alternative ontology of Auschwitz to the one offered by his community, with a temporality that must be knit back into the present rather than estranged and reified as trauma. His testimony refuses to be recuperated to a redemptive narrative, to an account of the relationship of those extraordinary events to ordinary life that smooths over the rent in existence by placing all horror into an unnatural realm. Yuri's banal ontology offers a method of survival which takes account of the past by bringing it into the present as a potentiality or virtual existence that endures alongside the survivor, thus allowing them to continue their uncontinuable life. Likewise, this ontology locates evil within the community as a potentiality that awaits circumstance and must continually be managed in the present to guard against catastrophe that would otherwise seem to originate from without, in the guise, for instance, of the SS man. Katesha's resistance against a Manichaean approach to ethics, then, also responds to a tendency in both trauma theory and the memorialisation of genocide to situate evil outside of all imaginable experience and the perpetrators of harm outside our community. Yuri's ethical ambiguity reminds us of the fragility of communal norms and the danger of ignoring this fragility. And while Frank's final ignored testimony repudiated others' expectations, Yuri shows that in order to survive and become who he can be, he must also flout his community's expectations by bearing witness for himself from the position of infancy. Okay, so I've got a short conclusion, which hopefully wraps it all up. Okay, the child's perspective that had interpolated the reader of fragments promised an impossible moral clarity through which one may be absolved of responsibility for the terrible events of last century. Its seduction consisted in the permission it gave the reader to remain ignorant of the grey zone, of their own implication in social and political systems that reward a privileged few on the basis of subjugation of the unseen and forgotten many. Wilkomirski achieves this identification by furnishing the reader with evil figures of excess through which to divest feelings of guilt about social privilege, ethical ambiguity and complicity. Yet more than this, identification with Wilkomirski's infantile perspective enabled the reader to take the view from above as if it were the view from below, and in this way pretend to an equality between actors that would then allow them to speak in the child's place, and indeed which allowed the Swiss Bruno Dursica to speak in the place of an infant Jewish Holocaust victim from Riga. The notion in trauma theory of vicarious trauma enacts a similar quandary of identification, wherein the colonisation of others' experience for the sake of the production of poignancy capital is mistaken for taking responsibility for the other. The Wilkomirski scandal exposed not only the author's fraud, but also his reader's complicity, galvanised by a complicated desire for release from the implications of the grey zone. I'd like to finish, however, by rereading the Wilkomirski effect in order to activate the antinomies of trauma theory and identification in more productive and subtle directions. Considered from the side of the fraudster, the scandal enabled a recognition of moral complexity by disclosing the dominance of the Holocaust as a site of suffering and the stark delineation of evil and innocence that its memorialisation produces. Bruno Dursica understood that had he been a survivor of Auschwitz, rather than only of poverty and the Swiss foster care system, he would have been able to attract sympathy without reserve. The moral complexity of Dursica's life story, the tragedy of which emerged from a systemic failure to respond to his and his mother's needs, led him to borrow the narrative of another Jewish boy, the image of which leaves no room for moral ambiguity. It is then finally flight from their own infancy, from moral complexity, indeterminacy and nascent complicity, that bound readers to Binyamin's plight and shamed them upon realising the scandal. the child witness, Wilkomirski, had promised security from moral ambiguity. What he yielded instead was an ethical aporia that returned readers back to their own infancy.
Thank you, Joe. Questions? Comments?